By many accounts, we do not do free time well in our society. Getting left alone with our thoughts for a while can be an issue if we're not also left alone with our smartphones or other web-connected devices. Many people report going online constantly in our hyper-connected world. Check the news, text friends, add thoughts to social media. We have trouble doing nothing. And this is where Jenny Odell comes in with a book called How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy. Note that term, attention economy. Jenny says it's an economy based on despair. We'll explore that and more ahead. Jenny Odell is an artist and writer and teacher at Stanford University. Her work has been exhibited in several parts of the world. And Jenny has served as artist in residence programs at Facebook and the San Francisco Dump, among other places. Jenny Odell, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So your first sentence, nothing is harder to do than nothing. Why is that, do you think?
I think some of that may just be unrelated to technology. I mean, I think we have long had ideas about what is a worthwhile and productive way to spend one's time. But I think it's definitely exacerbated lately by specific design aspects of the things that we use that keep us on them as much as possible.
So not a modern preoccupation. There is some history to being idle or being concerned about being idle, for that matter.
Yeah, definitely. And that's one of the reasons, you know, there is so much history in my book is because I'm kind of, you know, looking at this moment that we're in right now and then trying to trace that back and look at different ways that individuals and groups of people have kind of refused that rhetoric of productivity.
So it is not just idleness we're talking about here. What is the value you see in being unconnected to others for a time?
I think it really has to do with this incubation time in a way that I feel certain types of thoughts require. So I think it's something we're all instinctually aware of, that some types of knowledge require getting away for a little bit just to get some perspective. I think the book kind of came out of me just noticing that I was doing that individually, but I think a lot of us are familiar with that. So some of it is just getting perspective on the situation that you were just maybe very embroiled in. And then a lot of it just has to do with time. I think that actual reflection and wisdom comes from having time to process all of the information that you've taken in. And, you know, I should say also, it doesn't necessarily have to be solitary in my formulation of it. I mean, I think we have really valuable conversations with friends and family, but those conversations are very different than the types that we often have online.
All right. So more or less a chance to get away from whatever it is that your mind is gripped by, which we hear often in counsel, even at people at work. It's like if you need to get up from your desk a while, you might process a little better by taking a walk or something, but we don't seem to take to that well.
Yeah, it's strange. I mean, I think we might have this kind of fixation on really obvious and visible results. So my example of something that is, quote unquote, productive in a different way is just something like sleep, which is obviously necessary for us to function, extremely important, you know, but as an activity, it's sort of mysterious. It's kind of hard to point at aspects of sleep and say what they're doing. And I think it's hard for us to kind of grasp, parts of our lives or even parts of our environment that are useful in a different way, maybe not such an obvious way. The results of something, you know, don't even show up until years down the road. Maybe you think about something for a really, really long time and aren't sharing it on social media. And that's something that I feel has been important in my life personally, just because I'm an artist. And, you know, but I think anyone who makes anything or likes to think deeply about anything knows that that requires time.
There was a phrase you just used in there about how things are useful to us, which sort of goes along with some profound words you provide in the book about life being more than an instrument. I mean, how should we view life?
I mean, I think we're definitely in this culture right now where we see ourselves and our lives as a product, and that product can be optimized and streamlined. There's this kind of idea that there is like a optimal end goal to like how you should be and how you should express yourself. And for me, I have a very different idea of, at least for me, like what has been meaningful in my life. And it's really something very different. It's sort of just being alive to what is there and being surprised by it and being willing to be changed also. I talk a lot in the book about, you know, what sort of the opposite would be of personal branding, because obviously social media encourages things like personal branding. And the idea with that is that you become more and more something identifiable, like a brand. And I'm sort of trying to push against that with this suggestion that you would actually do the opposite and that you would become almost more like porous as a person, and that you would be more open to surprise, to having your mind changed, to recognizing that the self is this kind of fluid thing that changes in different situations and over time, and that that's something really beautiful that we should embrace.
So that people couldn't pigeonhole you or just assume that they know, you know, this is the Jenny brand, and for the same way, it would go the other way, where you wouldn't always look at life the same way.
Right, and we wouldn't look at each other that way. I mean, I think I talk a lot about attention, obviously, and how we can sort of deepen it and different forms of attention, and one really big part of that is patience. And I think if we are patient in our attention, oftentimes things and people will turn out to be a lot more complex than we thought.
Jenny, you described doing nothing as an act of political resistance. To whom or what?
I mean, I think it's a part of, you know, obviously a larger program of action. But for me, it's just kind of, I also refer to it in the book as a restorative way station for someone who wants to actually do something. So I think any kind of, you know, just thinking critically about a situation, but on top of that, things like organizing require conversations with oneself and with others that are often highly nuanced, require a lot of context and time and patience. And I just sort of worry that that is being taken away by the persuasive design of social media that, you know, wants us to express ourselves quickly in sort of little bits all the time.
Here we come back to the idea of the attention economy. We'll talk more in detail about what that means and about resisting it. Resisting the Attention Economy is the subtitle of Jenny O'Dell's book, How to Do Nothing. We'll come back and talk more with Jenny. And if you'd like to join us, you can come in by phone at 800-838-3760. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Jenny O'Dell, How to Do Nothing, and you in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening, and thank you for joining us in potentially doing nothing, because that's what Jenny O'Dell urges us to do, and we'll define doing nothing a little more carefully as we go through the hour. Her book is called How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy. Jenny is an artist and writer and teaches at Stanford University. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. There are some reflections in the book about growing up in the San Francisco Bay Area. I noticed your Stanford bio lists you as a Bay Area native / captive. You got some mixed feelings, it sounds like, Jenny, about technology in Silicon Valley.
Yeah, I think the reason that I make digital art is probably, you know, influenced by being around computers and technology and kind of getting to play around with them as a kid. And I definitely still think, you know, as someone who teaches digital art now, think that it provides really amazing opportunities, not just for artists to make things, but to help us actually see more of what's around us, which is a lot of what I'm advocating for in the book. So, you know, like one of the examples I talk about is iNaturalist, which is an app that lets you take pictures of plants and, you know, gives you a pretty good guess of what it is. And that's just purely amazing to me. At the same time, you know, you also have the more nefarious designs that we're all kind of grappling with right now. And this also came out of, a lot of this came out of this area. On top of that, you know, I find that there's a kind of bottom line mentality in Silicon Valley that's sort of similar to what I was describing earlier, with this kind of fixation on innovation, newness, constantly producing something, you know, constantly disrupting something. And so I feel like a lot of my arguments in the book have formulated have been formulated over and against that, and kind of trying to put some value also on things like maintenance and care, and just sort of like community repair, and making sure that everything is sort of everything that is already here is thriving, and paying attention to what is just in front of us.
Maintenance and repair on natural systems is part of that. You take your students in the digital design class on a field trip, you tell us in the book, and what goes on the field trip?
So we go to basically a nature preserve that is not too far from campus, and we visit, there's a really great visitor center there, and it gives you a lot of information about just the kind of different habitats that you'll find there, the history of the place, you know, and then so we look at that and then kind of go on this hike and reflect on how different your experiences of a space, just having that information. And then I also have them use that app that I just mentioned to learn about the different species that are around them. And I find that it's a really magical experience because most of my students live on campus, which means that they live not far from there. And it's been really great to see their sort of surprise, which mirrors the surprise that I talk about in the book when I started learning about this region or about my bioregion, this kind of feeling of like, oh, I've looked at this stuff for so long, and maybe I wasn't even looking at it at all, but it's been here the whole time. And it turns out that it's, you know, extremely detailed and complex and interrelated in all these really interesting ways. So it's kind of this feeling of like waking up to what is in front of you.
Looking around and noticing things that have always been there.
Yeah. I mean, it's really, it's quite amazing just as an experience. And it's part of something that I'm trying to do as a teacher, which is to show them that, you know, we have these ideas, especially in design, about newness, and that newness means making a new thing or putting a new thing or object or product in the world. But that there's this other way that you can approach it where you could design a walking tour, for example, which is their final project, and give that walking tour to somebody, and they will, from that point on, have a new experience of that space. And that is also producing something. It's producing new attention and new perception in someone that they might have for the rest of their lives. And I think of that as being hugely productive.
So Jenny, there was a precipitating set of issues in your life. I mean, what pushed you to the journey to create the book, How to Do Nothing?
It came from basically a moment in late 2016, just looking at what was happening on social media and observing, you know, in myself and others, this almost like abusive relationship to media, like sort of feeling really overwhelmed by it, but also subjecting ourselves to it all the time. Obviously, the way that people were communicating online was just, you know, basically it felt like a shouting match. And then this kind of insane rate of headlines, not to mention just like clickbait headlines. So that was going on. And then we also had the Ghost Ship warehouse fire here in Oakland. And a lot of artists were in that warehouse. So it was just sort of this period of time where I, as an artist and a writer, wasn't really sure, you know, didn't feel like I could say or do anything, felt sort of paralyzed. And I was also noticing that in others around me. So I observed that I had been going and sitting in this garden that is about 5 minutes from my apartment, and just doing nothing. And so it really, like, that was the seed of the entire thing, was just trying to answer the question of why it felt necessary to do that, and also why I felt guilty doing that. I think a lot of us feel guilt about needing to step away even just to preserve our own sanity. But something that I'm really trying to advocate for is a balance between stepping away and engaging that ultimately gives you a way to experience your life more meaningfully, but also, you know, take the actions that you feel you need to take. How to Do Nothing was originally a talk that I gave at a conference that came out of that experience. And then over the next year or so, it became a book.
Well, and the research has been thorough. I mean, we've talked already about the fact that there's some history here that people have complained in the past about not having enough time to do things. And then you get into some labor history as well, you have some lessons in here about workers and time. I mean, we got 8-hour days, but then what have we done with all the off time we used to have?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of depressing the more I think about it. I, you know, in the book talk about the movement for the 8-hour workday. I also talk about the 1934 waterfront strike here in San Francisco. And it's like these, you know, I more and more starts to seem like these small moments of victory and like a sea of otherwise like instability and precarity. Like those protections have just become so eroded at this point. So I kind of compare the moment in which we had the 8-hour workday to what we have now with things like the gig economy, and, you know, the number of people with more than one job, you know, and the amount of student debt. You basically have 24 potentially monetizable hours, where, you know, if you aren't making the most out of every hour, it's imagined as sort of your fault. So perversely, you know, we're all imagined as our own entrepreneurs that have these, you know, this X number of hours, and we're kind of trying to squeeze every last drop out of it. So it's important for me to acknowledge that in the book, because you can't talk about things like leisure and off time and time for reflection without recognizing this very real economic reality that we're living in.
Right. And you know, we thought we'd gotten some gains made back from the days when we worked 6 days a week and sometimes 12 to 16 hours a day. At least that much has changed. Jenny Odell is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, an artist and a writer who teaches at Stanford University. She's written a book called How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy. You can join the conversation on the Exchange by phone, 800-838-3760. Your thoughts on what you do when you don't have to do something, 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. First phone calls from Bill and Eugene. Welcome to the Exchange.
Hi, thanks for having me. I have a question regarding your attention society. I'm just wondering, what do you think is the basic cause? Because I see it everywhere. Everybody seems to put their life on the internet and Facebook. From their whole life's on there. Anybody can see anything. Also, you see it out and about where people are completely tattooing their bodies to see. It's like everybody has to be seen or sell themselves somehow. I just wonder where you think this might have developed from.
All right. So is personal branding a public in-person thing too, you think, Jenny?
Yeah, I think, you know, it probably comes from a lot of different things, depending on the person. So there's definitely this, even for someone who wouldn't maybe explicitly say that they're interested in personal branding, that mentality has definitely filtered into, I think, just almost the general public in a way. And so you have like this idea that if you don't constantly express yourself online, you cease to exist. It's almost like people sort of need to see themselves confirmed and reflected back by, you know, number of likes or number of comments. And I think, you know, once you get far enough down that path, you really start to kind of believe it. Like you really, you know, if it's not expressed online, it really doesn't feel real to you anymore. So I think that's part of it. And then I think also the other part comes from, or is maybe related to what I was saying earlier about everyone imagining themselves as an entrepreneur. It's like, we live in this moment where everyone thinks that their hobby could become a side hustle. So, you know, you don't just make paintings on the side. You also sell them on Etsy. You don't just, you know, do leisure activities. You sort of perform them on Instagram, hoping to sort of get noticed for some reason. And so I think it's a sort of weird effect of, again, seeing oneself and one's life as a product that you could sort of be getting more value out of by representing it a certain way online.
So constantly having to be on.
And being afraid of some sort of imagined like insignificance if you were not to do that.
Here's another call from Carter in Wolf Creek. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jenny Odell.
Yeah, good morning. I'm aware that doing nothing as a English phrase is an oxymoron. And I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean that in the sense that if a person actually sees what I just said, then things mentally tend to get quiet. And what I'm especially invested in personally in my life is to go all the way with what your guest is saying this morning, and that is into allowing the mental activity of the brain to actually become quiet. And unfortunately, amongst a lot of neurological professionals, there's disagreement of what I'm saying. And there is, however, a basic neurological reality, and that is that the nervous system not only communicates with itself by positive pulses, but by the spaces between the pulses. And I'll leave the listeners to think about that.
All right. Thank you very much, Carter. It reminds me of the statement about the music. There's lots of stuff to consider between the notes as well as the notes themselves. What do you think about what you just heard, Jenny?
I don't actually address really any neurology in my book, although I do talk about vision studies a little bit. But just on a sort of intuitive, experiential level, I am always amazed at the kind of transition that happens when you walk away, from your computer or your phone or whatnot. Or, I shouldn't even put it that way. It's not a hard line. Like, it's just when you kind of start paying a different kind of attention. And what I'm suggesting in the book is that you pay attention to what is around you. It is amazing how much the sort of clamor that is happening inside your mind will quiet down. And sometimes I find that it takes quite a while. Like, I'll go on one of my standard walks and it might take, an hour, depending on what was going on. But inevitably, the sort of volume of things in your mind will sort of decrease or slow down. And it is, for me anyway, I always experience that as such a huge relief. And I am willing to sort of trust that relief, that means that that's somehow good for me.
Let's take another call. Here's Cynthia in Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jenny Odell. Her book is How to Do Nothing.
Hi there, Jenny. This is Cynthia Kerr and my daughter Diana, and you used to play when you were kids.
Hi.
Hi. As I recall, you were mostly TV-free and very creative in your play.
Oh, yeah, but that's true. Yeah, my parents only let me watch PBS.
Yeah. I'm definitely going to get your book, and I wanted to just find out if you had integrated anything about mindfulness meditation, because it sounds like it could really weave with that, the mindfulness meditation, which is basically non-judging and being in the moment and the full, all the senses and that type of thing. So I'd be interested in hearing if you have any experience with that.
All right. Thanks for the call, Cynthia. And thanks for the memories.
Yeah, it's so nice to hear from you. I think what I'm describing is very similar to meditation as, practiced formally by a lot of people. I, interestingly, it's never been very easy for me to meditate in terms of the sort of just like sitting in one place, especially with one's eyes closed. My sort of form of meditation is to walk around often very slowly and just kind of like look at things really closely. It looks and feels very different, but I think it's sort of achieving the same ends, which is to become receptive and open to, again, what is around you. I think meditation also has a lot in common with something I talk about in chapter one, which is deep listening. Deep listening was the sort of legacy of a sound artist and composer named Pauline Oliveros. And if you read her sort of description of what deep listening is, it sounds a lot like meditation. It's sort of just sitting and becoming completely open and receptive and listening to every single possible sound that you could listen to, both inwardly and outwardly. And so I don't actually ever specifically talk about meditation in the book, almost because it's so obviously implied. I think anyone who has practiced meditation will recognize its sort of effects in the different kind of activities of observation that I talk about in the book.
Right. So no specific mentions of meditation, no specific mentions of neuroscience, which we just talked about. So no fMRIs or parts of the brain lighting up. But we do get to birds. Birds figure prominently in your story of figuring things out. Had you noticed them much before?
I had just kind of started to notice them shortly before that whole kind of moment where I was sitting in the Rose Garden. I had read a book that I highly recommend called The Genius of Birds, and really opened my eyes to, the animal intelligence in general, which is an amazing thing to think about, but specifically in birds, which, up until fairly recently were not thought of as being very intelligent, at least in the way that we define intelligence. And so that had kind of prompted me to look at them a little bit more closely. And then, as I talk about in the book, around the time that I was sitting in the Rose Garden, I was also befriending some neighborhood crows who I had learned in the book know how to recognize human faces. And so I have now known these crows for, you know, over 2 years, and I see them most mornings on my balcony. And I've also sort of seen them around the neighborhood. And that ends up being a really pivotal moment for me in that chapter of having an opportunity to see myself from the perspective of an animal that recognizes me. And just kind of imaginatively being able to inhabit this very different perspective on the same reality that I'm inhabiting.
So it tells you that there's a reality other than the one that you walk around with.
Absolutely. And it also kind of forms a bridge to other things that I hadn't noticed. Like I talk about the fact that it was through these crows that I kind of noticed the shape of the hill that I live on. Like its overall shape, where all of the tall trees are, where, you know, if you were a crow, you would land in. And then, you know, even things like time. Animals are obviously living in a different type of time than human time.
Huh. It's just like the way I notice the ducks in the neighborhood when they're sitting in the irrigation ditch. I notice the wires they have to fly through. How careful they are about the spaces. Yeah, you get to know a little more about the world around you through the way that other creatures experience it. That is among the things that Jenny O'Dell observes in her book, How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy. Welcome back to Talk More with Jenny. And if you'd like to join us, we'll take phone calls and emails from you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Jenny O'Dell, writer and artist and teacher of digital art at Stanford University. Jenny's work has been exhibited in several parts of the world. She served an artist-in-residence program at Facebook and another one at the San Francisco Dump, among other residency programs. She's written a book about not doing things, about just letting the world around us soak in. It's called How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy. It seems to require us to be on our cell phones and devices all the time. You can join the conversation on the exchange as we explore this further. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I love the story of your accidental digital detox last summer in the Sierra. What happened, Jenny?
I was staying in a rental cabin that did not have cell reception, which I think I actually suspected that would be the case, but I lost reception way earlier than I expected to. So I didn't have a chance to sort of tell the world that I would be offline. I just, you know, got there and was like, you know, no way to communicate anything with anyone. And I was also by myself. And so I write about in that chapter the odd transition that happened where initially I was sort of freaking out about how disconnected I felt and how I wasn't going to be able to get any of the information that I need. You know, how am I going to stream music? Like all of these questions. And then after about, you know, 15 or 20 minutes, it was fine. And I was amazed at the way that my phone just looked like this inert object, you know, it wasn't this like charged, kind of communication device that's this portal to all these other places. Like it just was kind of sitting there. And the only things that I could use it for were as a flashlight and as a timer.
So it really was a slab of stuff. It was, yeah, really low technology instead of what it's usually capable of. So totally. So there's a long riff in the book about dropping out, like happened in the 60s and 70s. People wanted to get away from society for reasons similar to the reasons some people talk about it now. They were fed up with the political system. So as you explore this, I wonder if you've reached some conclusions about getting away physically versus staying physically in society, but disconnecting. We can do this without going off in the country, can't we?
Yes, I think so. It's certainly helpful, you know, if you can afford it or get away with it, to go on a short trip somewhere and, you know, especially if you're like me and you appreciate ecology and, you know, seeing all of, you know, but spending time in the non-human world, you know, I really value going on trips for that reason. But that whole chapter about the kind of dropping out ends on this note, largely inspired by Thomas Merton, the monk, or I guess hermit, from the mid-20th century, who had, you know, wrote so much about social and political issues and was really quite engaged from his position of being a hermit. I kind of come to this conclusion that it may feel very tempting to just sort of retreat, even just like psychologically where you are, for good, and just kind of say to heck with it all. And that that's sort of obviously unethical in a lot of ways. It's also a bit impossible, I think. And I suspect that anyone who's buying this book ultimately wants to do something, even if it's just to have more meaning in your life. So I end with this figure of sort of refusing in place, which is to continue to, you know, participate in a way where you are, but with this kind of slight removal in your mind where you're not sort of participating the way that you are supposed to. So, you know, it's very akin to just like thinking or reading critically, like you are still taking in the information, but you're not consuming it in maybe the way that it's designed to be consumed. So that is why, you know, the next chapter is about how we can sort of shift our attention just like within the space of our own minds.
Well, and the risks of staying there, as you point them out, there's some profound words in here about, you say despair is the very stuff the attention economy runs on. I mean, are we using these things because we're unhappy, or think we're going to prevent ourselves from being unhappy by using them?
I think so. I mean, I think some of it's, you know, inability to maybe like sit with some of the more uncomfortable emotions that we might feel. And I think, you know, I suspect that some of it is also very real emotional reactions to like really awful stuff that is happening and really scary things. Like, you know, it's hard to sit with the idea of climate change. It's, you know, it's emotionally difficult. And just like any other difficult emotion, I think the mind kind of wants to go anywhere else, to do anything else, to be engaged in anything rather than sit with that. So, and then you have the added thing of, you know, constantly checking back in on things feels like you're sort of doing something, or you're, which obviously you need to be informed, like that's part of being responsible, but constantly kind of subjecting yourself to that, and also just consuming information very quickly without looking into context or things like that, or doing like deeper research. I think that these are, you know, it's almost like the fidget spinner of like emotional despair in a way. And unfortunately that's highly profitable for a platform that wants to keep people engaged as much as possible.
Well, the idea of profit and the attention economy certainly resonated with one of our listeners, Jason in Trail, Oregon. He writes, "I've been a writer in residence off and on for many years, using poetry to encourage students and teachers to acknowledge and explore ambiguity in their lives, something the digital world abhors. I also had a long career since 1994 running online game studios and large teams of engineers and artists. It's scary that even our online worlds, League of Legends, Fortnite, etc., have become almost completely about acquisition, micro purchases, loot boxes, item display on avatars, etc. There's little wonder, little ambiguity, little exploration. They are thoroughly monetized, just as our real lives have become." Thanks, says Jason in Trail.
That's super profound. It reminds me that I, you know, there's this important point that I make in the book that I actually don't have a problem with the idea of social media in itself. I have a problem with the idea of commercial social media. You know, I give some examples at the end of non-commercial decentralized social networks, where, you know, it's still performing a function, which is to share information with other people. Obviously that is a huge utility, but it doesn't have the same financial incentives, you know, regarding advertising and, you know, ownership of our data. And, you know, as that listener noted, any kind of system where you're making money off of something or some type of information becomes a product, it becomes like currency. And I think currency, even attention is currency at this point. One aspect of currency is that it's standardized, and it's imagined as being sort of homogeneous. You can break it into homogeneous units. It's kind of always the same. And so all, you know, everything kind of gets leveled in a way. And everything is kind of expected to fit into certain types of boxes. Otherwise, it just kind of isn't legible or doesn't show up. And a lot of the book is kind of motivated by a concern about what that would mean for the self, because I see us sort of applying that logic to the way we even think about parts of ourselves, like which parts of ourselves are useful and which aren't.
And it's more than that. I mean, the fact is that, you know, everything on us is on us for a reason. You know, all the things we notice are there for a reason. I mean, we don't know what the reason is, I guess. But the fact
is, you don't have to know what the reason is.
Let's take another call. Here's Frank in the Rogue Valley. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jenny O'Dell, the author of How to Do Nothing.
Hey, am I on?
Yes.
Hey. Well, thanks for the book. I'm a guy in my mid-50s. I've never had a smartphone, because my flip phone was working when smartphones came out. And I just saw people getting more and more pulled into an attention-seeking device that, to me, is pulling people away from being quieter. I don't think the mind's any busier than it used to be because of social media and all that, because the mind's its own thing and it's a busy place. But I just see people connecting less. I go into a restaurant and everybody's on their phones, and now we know psychologically that it's addicting and all this different stuff. And I got high-speed internet in my house. There's nothing that my, you know, every once in a while Siri in the city would be nice, but that's pretty much it. And then the only other the comment I wanted to make is, doing nothing is doing something.
All right. Absolutely.
Thank you for that, Frank. Appreciate it. So, and this is the point you're making. I mean, it's not really nothing. It's diverting your attention. And is it becoming more passive, Jenny, in the sense of you're letting the world come into you? You're letting things come into your awareness just by sitting there?
Yeah, that's definitely part of it. I also, you know, I think doing nothing, you know, absolutely is doing something. Again, as an artist, I have been familiar for a long time with the sort of tension between like the way that the things that you need to do and the time that you need to spend to be able to even come up with an idea for something to make, the tension between that and this expectation of some kind of result, some kind of visible thing that you would have to show for your time. So, you know, it's something that I tell my art students actually when they're asking for advice, because a lot of them are not art majors. And I tell them, you know, my number one advice is give yourself twice as much time as you think you need to work on the project, because half of that time isn't going to feel like work. It's just going to feel like walking around and maybe talking to a friend about it. But that might be the most important part of the quote unquote work. And so it's the sort of nothing that I talk about. It's kind of like a joke, because it's just appears to be nothing from someone else's perspective, but from the point of view of your experience and your thought, it's at least in my experience, incredibly rich. Like, a lot is happening. It's just that you're not producing anything in an obvious way.
Well, there's a term in here that really resonated with me, which is the idea of a third space. You know, the idea that it's not just this or that, but there's also another alternative that you often don't think about.
Yeah, just the kind of space around the question itself. So that's the part where I talk about Bartleby the Scrivener, the short story by Melville, where, you know, without getting too much into it, you have a character who works for a lawyer and is supposed to be basically a clerk. And the narrator keeps asking him to do something very simple, like some paperwork, basically. And he keeps saying, I would prefer not to. And it so bothers the narrator, because he's not saying no, but he's also not saying yes. He's saying, I would prefer not to. So it's like he's sort of negating the question itself. And I find that really interesting. I give some other examples from art of ways of, again, sort of like I was saying, participating but not as asked. So kind of inhabiting this space around what previously seemed like a very black and white or yes or no question.
You had talked earlier about the idea of maintaining, that we don't have to constantly create or disrupt. And I wonder, I mean, I assume you have lots of friends who work in the technology industry, or at least some colleagues on campus who have at least connections to it, or what they think about some of the critiques that you have made about the what we call the attention economy.
You know, I actually don't have that many friends who work in tech. And I have one friend who who's reading the book right now, and I'm very interested to talk to him about it after he's done. But I kind of, you know, to be honest, like my circles are more sort of like artists and writers. And so it's no accident that I put a lot of value on art and writing and poetics in the book, and I hate to use the word utility, but the utility of those disciplines. So I have noticed that, at least online, ironically on Twitter, a lot of people in tech seem to be reading the book, and taking that critique to heart, and thinking about, this idea of care and of health. The problem is, you know, there are things like, an initiative called Time Well Spent, which is run by former technologists, and it's entirely devoted to eradicating persuasive design, so an addictive design, and obviously that would be a very fruitful thing to do, but where I sort of differ from them is that the name Time Well Spent, it sort of stays in the realm of time is money, and that you should optimize your time in your life. And my argument is a little bit maybe messier, where it's kind of like, no, you can't optimize your life. Your life is not a performance. And in the sort of Bartleby way, like maybe one should just walk away from that question altogether.
I do love the fact that you puzzle over the fact that once you started noticing birds, that people call it bird watching, and you think it should be called bird noticing, because it really is about noticing what goes on in the world around you. That is a large part of How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy by Jenny O'Dell. Jenny, you filled up the phone lines. I have three people to apologize to because I don't have time to take their calls. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you for having me.
All right, take care.